More from Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, Charlie Sykes and the crime and consequences of the killing of Charlie Kirk. Also, D.C. residents on the end of President Trump's declared crime emergency. Two former negotiators who say the framework for any Israel-Palestine agreement has been wrong for decades. And Jay Duplass and Michael Strassner on The Baltimoreans, their film about a troubled and funny man who is trying to recover in all ways.
Just continuing to say, as corny as it sounds, you know, yes and to life. Life gets bigger and bigger the more you're open to it.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, September 13, 2025.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. When Rob Worsham interviewed for his internship, he was asked, are you comfortable walking in the middle of 60 black bears?
I'm retired Army and I've been in some interesting places and I was like, sure, why not? 60, I didn't think, you know, that big a deal.
Worsham's now been with the Vince Schuette Wildlife Sanctuary for almost a month.
There's nothing like standing in a crowd of 100 black bears and go, oh my.
The nonprofit American Bear Association runs the sanctuary, which is 10 miles northwest of Orr as the crow flies. There, interns like Rob, volunteers, and a handful of staff feed the bears.
We try to kind of feed them a natural diet. It's just dried fruits, nuts, seed, to just, yeah, to complement what they're already going to eat out there in the wild.
Steph Horner is the president and executive director.
There's not fences, there's not cages, they're coming and going as they please, some more than others.
The meals looked a little different when the feeding first started decades ago. Vince Schuette was a logger, and he and his men often dealt with black bears breaking into their camp. After 3 decades of shooting and killing the nuisance bears, he tried something else.
He was like, gosh, they seem to really like my sourdough pancakes, so maybe I should just make them a separate batch. I'll place it away from the cabins and see what happens.
It worked in that it stopped the break-ins. Horner says the troubles of feeding wildlife weren't really known at the time.
Once bears learn a food source, they don't forget a food source, so they continued to come back. I like to say, you know, it wasn't, sure, it wasn't right, but Vince was ahead of his time. He was trying to peacefully coexist with the wildlife that he was sharing a home with.
More and more people came to visit, feeding the bears junk food and trash.
People were doing crazy things like putting kids on the bears' backs and stuff like that. And so not only were there fears of people getting hurt, but it was super disrespectful to the bears.
The nonprofit began in 1995 and built the first deck for visitors to observe from. 10 to 15,000 people visit each year between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Their admissions, plus a gift shop and photography workshops, fund the sanctuary's work. Horner acknowledges that feeding the bears is no longer best practice, and continuing to do so is controversial. In nearby Net Lake, Boys Fort band members have expressed concern that the practice is making the bears too comfortable around humans, leading to potential conflict. Horner says there's concerns that if feeding stopped, it could lead to even more conflict. Tourists who come to surrounding resorts aren't bear aware, and their poor practices could cause problems for suddenly hungry bears.
But, you know, this is a great opportunity for people to learn about bears and to learn how to be bear aware. So we pride ourselves in being a facility that teaches that.
She says that's why the sanctuary's work is important.
The more people that you teach about them, they're going to learn and understand the animal. They're going to ultimately care more about that animal.
The internship program is another education element. The sanctuary gets 15 to 30 interns throughout the season. Ava Stark graduated from UCLA in the spring with a bachelor's in ecology, behavior, and evolution. Thursday was her last day. She says the highlight was witnessing the magic of bear behavior.
Because I really am interested in wildlife behavior and wildlife conservation, and just the work they do here is great.
With Stark's departure, Worsham is the final intern of the season. He'll be there until the last bear leaves to hibernate. The 56-year-old from Pennsylvania isn't your typical intern, but he was bad at retirement. He's pursuing a wildlife rehab certificate and needed the experience. He also loves the bear behavior.
It's kind of special to see and learn. Yeah, two cubs pretending to be adults going. Because I've been watching just this last week alone, the cubs are practicing adulting.
Despite its history, the sanctuary isn't very well known. Horner says it relies heavily on word of mouth.
I would love to scream it at the top of my lungs and for everybody to know about us.
The Vince Schuette Wildlife Sanctuary is always looking for volunteers, she says, and reopens to visitors again Memorial Day weekend. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. A suspect has been arrested in Utah in the killing of Charlie Kirk. He was shot Wednesday during an event at Utah Valley University after answering a student's question about gun violence. At a press conference yesterday, Governor Spencer Cox of Utah said the shooting was more than an attack on one person.
It is an attack on all of us. It is an attack on the American experiment. It is an attack on our ideals.
Charlie Kirk's murder and reaction to it has many people fearful about what the future may hold for America and its ideals. Our next guest is the political analyst and host of the To the Contrary podcast, Charlie Sykes, who joins us from Milwaukee. Charlie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You and Charlie Kirk disagreed about a lot, mm-hmm. but what were your thoughts when you heard about his shooting?
Well, I was shocked and sickened because, in this country, we do not use violence to counter ideas with which we disagree. And as you mentioned, Charlie Kirk and I were on very opposite ends of the political spectrum, but he was a human being, he was a father, he was a husband, and this should never have happened. I was sickened by it.
You talked about Charlie Kirk on your podcast just a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. How do you think he became so influential politically?
Well, Charlie Kirk, was, and it is very difficult to overstate his importance for moving Gen Z voters to the right. He organized on college campuses. He was out there. He was debating. He was willing to engage other people, but also he used the new environment of social media, use those algorithms to build a massive audience. And, unfortunately, that included making incendiary and often, deeply offensive comments. But those are that's the sort of politics that is increasingly incentivized and rewarded on social media today.
In the last few years, apparently, Charlie Kirk and his organization, Turning Point, had run into a kind of rivalry with extremist Nick Fuentes. Mm-hmm. What effect do you think that had?
Well, we don't know. I mean, there's a lot of speculation out there, and I think that we need to be cautious about all of this. But yes, one of the great rivalries on the right was with the so-called Groypers who follow Nick Fuentes, who is a white supremacist. And this rivalry had been rising. In fact, on a podcast a few weeks ago, I discussed, how this will play out on college campuses, the Nick Fuentes versus Charlie Kirk rivalry, as the political spectrum moves more extreme and further to the right. But again, it is too early to say whether that is what we're talking about here with the assassination of Charlie Kirk.
The polarization of our politics seemed to be on full display within really minutes of the shooting. Many condemned the act, including many who disagreed with Charlie Kirk. Others suggested that some of Charlie Kirk's own words had somehow provoked a shooting. Hear words from President Trump, who pointed at their opponents.
For years, those on the radical left have compared wonderful Americans like Charlie to Nazis and the world's worst mass murderers and criminals. This kind of rhetoric is directly responsible for the terrorism that we're seeing in our country today, and it must stop right now.
What do you make of the president's reaction? Did he make a fair point?
Well, the president could have assumed the role of comforter in chief, and instead Donald Trump chose to be the inciter in chief, the divider in chief. And of course, we don't know what the motivation of the shooter was. What's really troubling, though, is the way that he is really feeding this sense of anger and vengeance out there, and raises the question of whether or not this will be weaponized, whether we will see the federal government use its power to go after people who engage in speech that Donald Trump and his MAGA supporters don't agree with, which of course is deeply ironic, considering that Charlie Kirk defended much of what he did and said, you know, because it was an act of free speech. So what the president is saying, I mean, when you have the inflamer-in-chief sitting in the Oval Office with the biggest megaphone of all, it's deeply troubling.
Does each side seem to keep their own accounting about acts of political violence that don't account for the others?
That's one of the extraordinary things we've seen over the last three days, is that people on the right will argue that it's only people on the left who engage in political violence. Well, people on the left say it's only a right-wing phenomenon. The reality is that we have seen attacks on Republicans. We've seen attacks on liberal Democrats. We've seen an attacks on black people, on gay people. We've seen attacks on the CDC, on Governor Josh Shapiro, Gretchen Whitmer, Nancy Pelosi and her husband. You know, this has become a real contagion in American culture. But it is interesting how everybody has retreated into their own bubble and said the problem only exists on the other side. And we're not going to fix it until I think we get beyond that.
Can it be stopped?
I don't know. This is the question, because there are too many incitements. I mean, there are too many incentives for incitement and too much momentum and too much ideological investment in this kind of division. So I'm hopeful, but not necessarily optimistic.
Charlie Sykes, who writes the To the Contrary newsletter on Substack, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
President Trump's declared crime emergency in Washington, D.C. is over as of Thursday. The federal government can no longer exert control over the district's police force, but National Guard troops and federal agents remain for now. We sent NPR's Jennifer Ludden to see how D.C. residents are feeling.
I head first to the southeast D.C. neighborhood of Congress Heights, an area with high poverty and a history of high crime. 32-year-old Michael Jackson is waiting for a bus in a yellow vest for his job in maintenance and cleanup. He also lives nearby and says he's seen positive change the past month.
No more hanging out. You don't hear a lot of gun noises, a lot of gunshots. It's a lot more peaceful.
D.C.'s police department says violent crime during the surge fell 39% compared to the same time period last year. Jackson thinks the amped-up security sent a message to would-be criminals.
They really want to be involved with the ATF, FBI. So they give criminals a chance to think, like, do the right thing.
So does he worry that will end now that federal control of the police is over? Jackson says no, he hopes not.
Because of Donald Trump. I think if he feel like doing it again, I think he can do it again if he wants to.
Then a bus pulls up.
Is this your bus?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you,
ma'am. You have a blessing.
You too. Bye-bye.
A couple blocks down, Deuce Shelton is out for an errand. She's a retired preschool teacher and says crime here had already fallen before the federal takeover. The only change she's seen are the many National Guard troops posted near tourist sites, metro stations, and Union Station, a major transportation hub.
When I did go downtown, I would notice them basically harassing homeless people.
The White House says 50 homeless encampments have been dismantled during the surge. It's part of Trump's push to beautify the city. As for tackling crime, Shelton's not convinced.
The guy's an actor. Everything's a show.
She says the takeover did not worry her much. The district's always had an adversarial view toward federal oversight, but she thinks this is part of Trump's strategy to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
I just think it's a game to see how we're going to react to that, and also a game to see, oh, well, if we did it in D.C., we'll do it in this city, this city, this city.
Less than a half-hour metro ride away is the gentrifying U Street neighborhood. Early on, federal agents set up traffic checks here, arresting people for minor violations. The area is also full of restaurants with Latino workers who've been a target for immigration enforcement. Ana Garcia works in the area and worries this will have a lasting hit to the local economy.
I just think people are afraid to come to the city now, so I've seen a lot of restaurants not busy anymore.
D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says local police will no longer work alongside federal immigration agents. Around the corner, I chat with Abigail Friedman. She had a career in the State Department and is retired now. Probably exactly who you'd think would feel reassured by more security forces, she says, but she did not.
Really unsettling. I didn't feel safe. I felt like things could happen to me or to any of my neighbors or friends anytime. Things could get out of hand.
It made her think of an assignment in Afghanistan years ago with the military. The American soldiers there were always asking, why aren't the Afghans happy we're here to protect them?
When the National Guard came and ICE and Border Patrol, all of this stuff showed up here, I understood exactly how the Afghan people felt.
Friedman calls Trump's D.C. push a, quote, fig leaf for authoritarian rule. And it's made her think a lot more about how vulnerable the city is with its limited home rule.
I think the future means that those of us who live here have got to be more conscious about defending our rights, because if we don't speak up, we're just going to lose more and more and more all the time.
In fact, the very day Trump's crime emergency expired, a congressional committee took up a series of measures to exert more control over the district. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. Good morning. It is 8:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support for KAXE comes from Itasca County Health and Human Services, hosting the 17th annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. Happy Dancing Turtle in Pine River invites you to their garden this Thursday from 1 to 4. Learn about seasonal strategies, hoop houses, and more. And the Armory Arts and Event Center in Park Rapids has an open mic night this Thursday. Doors will open at 6. Performances start at 7. You can find a list of all kinds of events happening next week at our website, kaxc.org. Look for Events Up North. Thanks for tuning in this morning. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it, because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Well, I was a-climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high wear cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and now it's time for sports. Choppy waters ahead for the LA Clippers. The Green Bay Packers look like a cheddar juggernaut. And welcome, Ambassador Rizzo. Joining me from Chicago, sports reporter Michelle Steele. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet, Scott. Good morning.
The NBA is investigating the LA Clippers for possibly circumventing the salary cap so they can pay Kawhi Leonard $28 million, even above the millions he was getting paid. Another sports team owner controversy. I am shocked. What's the latest?
Yeah, and here's another shocking detail. It involves the Clippers. The whole reason that Steve Ballmer owns the team, right, Scott, is because the last guy, Don Sterling, caught in a scandal. He had to sell, and one of the 10 richest men in the world, former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, happened to be around and had a couple billion dollars to buy the team. So, you know, there's a lot of rich guys who own NBA teams, and one way to even the playing field between the filthy rich and just, you know, your run-of-the-mill rich guy is that the NBA has something called a salary cap. So stick with me here. It gets a little bit in the weeds, but in an effort to re-sign Kawhi Leonard, who's a very, very good player, to an extension in 2021, a journalist, Pablo Torre, found evidence that a company Ballmer made a hefty investment in just happened to contract Kawhi for an endorsement deal that strangely did not require him to actually do anything. Yeah, and this is in addition to the $40 million in actual salary the team was paying him. Now, that $40 million does count against the salary cap, but there's no evidence the team let the NBA know that all this was happening on the side. Now, I should mention, Ballmer has denied he knew anything untoward was happening, and he says he got conned.
It could be serious for basketball, couldn't
it? Oh, yeah. You know, there's a reason that the NBA has a CBA, a collective bargaining agreement, and there's very harsh penalties if teams are found to circumvent the salary cap. You know, there could be a fine. You could forfeit future draft picks. You could void the player's contract entirely. That would throw the roster into disarray completely. Yeah. And there's also the possibility of a punishment levied on Steve Ballmer. Now, he's not going to get a lifetime ban like Don Sterling did, but, you know, if you remember Glenn Taylor of the Timberwolves, he was suspended for 9 months for his role in a salary cap violation. So that would be a big deal, even for a guy that's got as much money as Steve Ballmer does.
So the NFL quickly, the pack is back.
Yes. I'm in Chicago, and I regret to inform Bears fans that, yes, the pack is indeed back. Boy, did they look dominant against the Commanders Thursday night. Now they're 2-0, and just to put that in context, they're the first team in NFL history to start the season 2-0 by beating two playoff teams from the last year in just a five-day span. And you know what, Scott? I can't think of too many other places that the Lombardi Trophy might feel at home than Green Bay.
Finally, Anthony Rizzo, who caught the peg to first base for the final out of the first Chicago Cubs World Series title in 108 years, returns to Wrigley today to retire as a Cub and take on a new role. I know I should be impartial, but I can't hold this back anymore. I love Anthony Rizzo and our daughter's favorite Major League ball player.
I can't think of a Chicago Cubs fan that doesn't love Anthony Rizzo, and who wouldn't love Anthony Rizzo. He's not from here, but he'll always be one of us, so to speak. He was absolutely, Scott, the heart of the team that broke the 108-year-old championship drought in 2016. He'll come back to Wrigley to retire today. He's going to sign a one-day contract. And he was asked if he was going to take an at-bat today, you know, given that technicality. He actually said he'd love to, but he's going to sit in the bleachers and try to start one of those beer cup snakes and start a rally there. But I love that he's going to remain associated with the team, and the team gets to keep their connection to really a beloved figure in Chicago.
Absolutely. Michelle Steele, thanks so much.
See you next time.
On this day, September 13th, in 1993, Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin shook hands at the White House and signed a framework for peace between Palestinians and Israel. I was in Jerusalem at the time. Everyone on all sides had lost someone. People said they just wanted peace to get on with their lives, free from terrorism, occupation, and hatred. There was hope. 32 years later, what happened? Hussein Agha and Robert Malley have both been a part of negotiations to end the conflict. Hussein Agha on behalf of Palestinians, Robert Malley for the U.S. under Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Biden. They've written a sharp and unsentimental new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Why did the peace process fail?
Well, you know, why it failed, that could take us several hours. But I think at bottom, it was premised on false assumptions. It was premised on a complete dissonance between what Israelis were looking for and what Palestinians were looking for. What Palestinians wanted, they wanted justice. They wanted a sense of redress. They wanted something to undo the catastrophe of 1948 when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their land. And what Israelis wanted was absolute security, absolute normalcy. And those things were not the same. And so for decades, people were working on a map and seeing whether you could divide the West Bank, whether you could divide Jerusalem, whether you could find a way to reconcile the two. But they were not even talking the language that most Israelis and most Palestinians held dear.
Mr. Agha?
For me, the peace process from day one was a fake process and could not have succeeded. It was a combination of illusions, delusions, lies, noise, missteps, misreadings. It was laden with all kinds of forces that are not amenable to success.
You assign plenty of blame, but you especially believe that the U.S. has not been a good mediator over the years. Let me get you both to respond to that, if possible.
Okay, maybe I'll start. This is a conflict that is between Israelis, Palestinians. It's not a conflict that involves the U.S. But neither one of them was really willing to make the compromises that were necessary to get the outcome, a two-state solution that the U.S. said it was seeking to achieve. So if you wanted to achieve in that pursuit, the U.S. needed to have a firm hand so that both sides understood the consequences of going in one direction, the consequences of going in another. But at bottom, the U.S. spoke one language, but didn't really put its effort where it said it wanted to go. And so you have this really pretty paradoxical situation of the most powerful nation on earth. Certainly that was the case in 1993 after the Cold War, was the sole superpower. Several presidents said that achieving Israeli-Palestinian peace was their priority, and yet they acted as if it was one of a series of concerns. They never put the weight into it that a superpower that claims that it is one of its main objectives would have put. And we could discuss what it is, but one of the diagnoses that we come out with in the book is that pursuit of Israeli-Palestinian peace was subordinate to other objectives that the U.S. was pursuing.
I think from the beginning, the process was not well thought out, because if you want to resolve a problem, you have to look and properly identify and define the core of that conflict. And I think the Americans never did that. They thought simply it was a material thing of dividing, partitioning the land between the two communities, and then everything would be okay. It was not about that. The importance of history, the emotions, the feelings, the aspirations, the yearnings, they were never factored in. What was really exclusively looked at was very technical. And this is not a technical conflict.
Are both Hamas and the current government in Israel, for their own reasons, just as satisfied to continue with the current state of affairs and continuing losses?
I tell you one thing about the current confrontation is that it crystallizes the true nature of the conflict. What Hamas has done is really more representative of what the Palestinians feel deep inside. Sorry to use terms that are not really very precise, but that's the nature of things. Things are not very precise.
You mean the October 7th attack that killed innocent people?
The October 7th attack. And then the war in Gaza was really a culmination of the feelings of the Israelis towards how to deal with the Palestinian threat and to how to get their security guaranteed, while at the same time, it did not have any political horizon to the kind of confrontation that diplomats could not resolve. Both sides were very determined on one thing, which was revenge.
You know, if you just look at sort of the reaction in Israel to the war, and, you know, I always hear people saying, well, this is Bibi and it's his government and he's perpetrating this war because he wants to escape his legal problems. All of that may be part of the picture. But look at the state of Israeli public opinion. Look at the polls. Look at the demonstrations. Do you see demonstrations, vast demonstrations against what's happening in Gaza, which increasing number of experts are calling a genocide? Do you see people up in arms?
I mean, I believe you do.
No, what you see is people demonstrating because they want the hostages back. But the support for the campaign, for the decimation of Gaza, that has been a consensus in Israel, including among members of the opposition that people like to point to as possible alternatives. So as we say in the book, this is not Netanyahu's war, this is Israel's. And on the Palestinian side, again, you didn't see large demonstrations against what Hamas did on October 7th to the extent there was criticism, and it's been more with time. It's criticism because they say, look at the consequence, not sort of on a moral plane. It was wrong because for many Palestinians, Israelis got their comeuppance after decades of dispossession, of displacement, of Gaza living like an open cage prison. The captives finally could take their revenge on their captors. So this doesn't sound, it sounds very unpleasant to say, but it is true that, you know, if you look at how Israelis reacted to the war, if you look at how Palestinians reacted, there is far more consensus than people believe when they say, well, we need to find moderate Israelis and moderate Palestinians. You need to understand how deeply the feelings went on both sides. I'm not saying to applaud it, but to say if that's the state of how both sides feel, it means that something has gone terribly wrong in the 32 years that you mentioned.
Is there any hope? Do you see any possibility for two people living together in peace, if not happiness?
Oh, the possibility of them being able to live in peace together is there. But you have to have a way of trying to address the conflict by starting by knowing what the conflict is, by defining it and identifying it properly to be able to deal with it. And this has not been the case. And as long as it's not the case, we'll be doing the same things over and over and over. And by the way, there is no accountability for the people who are doing the same thing over and over and over, and nothing happens.
I'd answer this way. Why did Hussein and I choose to write this book? Partly it's because we saw that so many people were saying, oh, it's happened, October 7th and everything. That's an aberration. That's an anomaly. How did it happen after this peace process? Whereas we argue it is a consequence of everything that preceded it and is in line with so much that preceded it. And we wrote the book to sort of shake things up and try to question some assumptions. And hopefully people who read the book, people who are going to think about this issue, will come up with a prescription and better ideas. But at a minimum, they won't keep their head in the sand and continue trying what has been done for so long and led to the disaster we're in today. So there's a lot I think we try to put on the table so that we rethink this conflict anew, because the way it's been thought of in the past has led us to the impasse we're in today.
Robert Malley and Hussein Agha, their new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. College football season is underway, but at Louisiana State University, the biggest story may have nothing to do with the game or B.J. Lederman, who writes our theme music. A 66-year-old has recently made his debut as one of the newest members of the LSU marching band. WWNO's Alana Schreiber tells us how he earned his spot in the purple and gold.
Kent Broussard was 11 years old when he went to his first LSU football game.
Something caught my attention there at Tiger Stadium, and it was the sound. It was the sound of the band in 1968, 1969. And I never forgot that sound.
That's the sound of the iconic first four notes of the LSU fight song.
Every Tiger fan, no matter where they are, no matter how old they are or how young they are, they always know those four notes.
But Broussard didn't go to LSU. He played sousaphone, a type of tuba, at Southeastern University in Hammond, a much smaller band where they didn't march. So when he retired from a career in accounting, he decided it was time to pursue his dream, try to join the Grammy-nominated Golden Band from Tigerland. He broke the news to his family over dinner.
Cheryl, my wife, said, "Hang on, what kind of band are you talking about? Are you talking about they have a senior band?" And I said, "No, it's not a senior band. I'm talking about the Golden Band from Tigerland. I'm talking about the 325 bandmates." And over that course of that dinner, I think they figured out that I was serious about it.
Remember, this isn't just a band. It's a marching band. So he had to get in the best shape possible.
I developed a regimen of lifting weights for about 6 months before the tryout. The second thing I did was I have been running or jogging since I've been 50, and I run between 20 and 25 miles a week. And then thirdly, I bought a weighted vest that I carried around on my chest for about 4 months.
And he picked up a sousaphone for the first time in 45 years. He retaught himself how to read music and found a teacher from the LSU music program.
We had lessons practically every week.
To be in the band, you have to be an LSU student, so Broussard enrolled as a non-traditional freshman. After 14 months of preparations, he was ready to submit an audition video. He got invited to tryouts, a grueling 5-day process of marching, playing, and sight reading over and over. On the last day, he went into the tuba room and saw his name on the list. Cheers went up.
They started hollering, "You made it, you made it." I started hollering, "I made it, I made it." I started jumping up and down.
On September 6th, Broussard made his debut. The 66-year-old freshman lined up with the band on Victory Hill next to the stadium. Together, they blasted LSU's iconic first four notes. And then they literally ran down the hill to the field. Broussard's not one to hog the spotlight, but he's happy to be inspiring older generations.
Hey, if you want to try something, try it. You may not succeed, but you got to try it.
Broussard will be in the tuba section tonight as the LSU Tigers take on the Florida Gators. For NPR News, I'm Alana Schreiber in Baton Rouge.
This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXC and Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. It's 8:39. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, we're going to the dogs, the cats, too. It's an hour of story and song celebrating the friend you can always count on. That will also air tomorrow evening, 5 p.m. The Bell Museum's statewide star party is September 18th through the 20th at 24 locations across Minnesota, including North Star Elementary in Virginia this Thursday, 3:30, and at the Blackwater Environmental Area in Cohasset, also on Thursday at 7 o'clock. There is more ahead from Weekend Edition.
I'm Dwali Saikautau with these headlines. President Trump is urging NATO nations today to stop buying Russian oil and to impose major sanctions on Russia. On his Truth Social post, he writes, "I am ready to do major sanctions on Russia when all nations have agreed and started to do the same thing." Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker and immigrant rights groups are asking for accountability after a 38-year-old father from Mexico was fatally shot by ICE officers yesterday near Chicago. And a new report shows that some 50 college campuses across the country have experienced a wave of threats and hoax calls in recent weeks, forcing several historically black colleges to cancel classes. I'm Dwali Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. How open and accessible should American college campuses be? More schools are asking that question after campus shootings like the one at Utah Valley University that killed Charlie Kirk, and after the encampments and protests that erupted 2 years ago in the wake of the October 7th attacks and the bombardment of Gaza. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny joins us now. Alyssa, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Scott.
You travel regularly to college campuses. How do they typically handle security these days?
It really is a wide range. So some campuses are completely open. You can walk into the library or academic buildings. You can have a picnic on the quad or use the bathroom in the student center. But increasingly, campuses are tightening security and restricting access. So take Columbia University in New York City. You can't walk through campus without a university ID. Other colleges, you've got to check in with a security officer before you can walk or drive through a campus gate. Tom Sicenti, the CEO of the National Association of Campus Safety Administrators, who served as a chief of police at several colleges and universities, has watched this trend unfold, and he said he understands why more and more campuses are starting to limit access.
As a law enforcement officer, I'm going to do everything I can to make it the most safe within my resources, right? And then also as a dad of a daughter who's going to college, I'm going to say, man, do I really want someone who has no affiliation that we can tie into the college to be walking through her living space, you know?
Listen, this does raise the question about who university is for. Is it members of the community, who in some cases, of course, fund the school with their tax dollars, or students?
Yeah, I talked with Dr. Michael Hindall, the president of Northwest Mississippi Community College, about it. His institution serves about 8,000 students with athletics and dorms and a big performing arts center on campus.
It is indeed a balance. Whether you're a community college like we are, or whether you're a university, on one side of this balance that I'm referring to, you know, it is making sure that students have a safe place.
You know, on the other side, I mean, it's called a community college for a reason, Scott. Heindel says working with the public is built into the school's vision statement, and he told me how much students and the community have to gain from interacting with each other.
most colleges and universities are beautiful places for people to engage in. And so I just think that those types of things are lost when an institution have to make the decision to wall itself off in that way.
So, Alyssa, what kind of burden does that put on security to keep a campus open?
Well, you know, the role of campus safety, campus police, has really changed in the last 20 years. The experts I talked to told me the Virginia Tech massacre, a shooting that happened on campus in 2007, where more than 30 people on campus were killed, really reshaped the role of campus police. And even two decades later, much of campus security comes down to resources. And that's in terms of the number of people they have on campus and what those officers are trained in, especially when it comes to these bigger outside speakers coming to campus. And then, of course, there's money. Here's Sicenti.
One license plate reader at one road doesn't help you at all. 20 license plate readers throughout campus is what helps you. And those things cost money. Sometimes it's just easier to set up a gate and have one person check every person that comes through.
The other thing he and other campus safety professionals told me is the wide range of responsibility these folks have. I mean, the vast majority of what he dealt with on campus was what he called parental in nature.
Listen, sometimes when the washer is overflowing and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, I get the phone call and I walk them through how to fix the washer, right?
But the reality is, from concerns about sexual assaults to protests to crowd control and fears of active shooter situations, campus police today are increasingly being asked to do so much more.
And bears listen, Ed Warney. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet.
When NPR's Brian Mann travels on assignment, he looks for wild and rugged places to explore. Sometimes that means winding up in places he never expected, like the Cascade Range in southern Washington state. Brian sent us this audio postcard.
I set off early, hiking the mountain trail, my goal high above a ridge of rock.
Climbing up through towering spruce trees. Everything's just lush and green.
I have a map, and my plan is to reach the summit of Silver Star Mountain. At first, I'm hiking fast, checking my wristwatch, trying to stay on schedule. But soon I find myself wading through waist-high ferns and asters, and I slow down. Deep in the forest, I find myself stopping to listen to chickadees tussling in the trees. I set off again, moving more slowly. Soon, I find myself in a maze of pathways, and I slow down even more. Even with my map, I'm not sure which way to go.
I've been just kind of piecing together sections of trail, marking them carefully so I know my way back. But it has kind of the feeling of exploring a little bit.
I've spent enough time in mountains that this kind of ramble feels less like being lost and more like realizing this is exactly where I want to be. And it's then, after I've stopped really trying, that I'm suddenly above the tree line.
There's a huge meadow here, and there's a cathedral structure of rock, and there's just mountains in every direction. You can hear it's perfectly still, really lavishly beautiful.
This is why I climb. Not summits or points on the map or schedules, but this silence. These moments when the world reminds me to slow down. I don't make it to the top. Instead, I sit and just laze for a while on a balcony of rock surrounded by peaks. Brian Mann, NPR News, on Silver Star Mountain in Washington State.
David Bowie has lived many lives through many personas. Aladdin Sane, the Blind Prophet, Ziggy Stardust, and now his archive is available in a new home in London, the David Bowie Center.
There is nowhere really like this that exists, so it's been tremendous to bring to life.
Visitors can select up to 5 items to be brought to them in a study room where maybe a future glam rock star can find inspiration. That story later today on All Things Considered. You can tune in on your radio or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. When we first meet Cliff, he is saved by the belt. You'll get that in a moment. Cliff seems to be in several different kinds of pain and has a lot of payment past due envelopes piled up. And he cracks a tooth and has to find a dentist who will see him on the day before Christmas. He does. Dee Dee.
All right, lean back. Open your mouth.
Whoa. What is that?
It's just a topical. It's going to numb you for the needle.
Ow!
I'm sorry. Are you okay?
Yeah. You're hardly going to feel anything. You're a big, strong guy.
Okay, I know it's stupid. Just do it.
The Baltimoreans is a new film directed by Jay Duplass and written by him and Michael Strassner, who also stars as Cliff, along with Liz Larson as Dr. Dee Dee. And just a warning, this interview contains references to suicide. Jay Duplass and Michael Strassner began by telling us the story of how they first connected.
Well, like any great love story.
In Greece.
Instagram.
I saw Jay followed me on Instagram, and I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing in the world. And the reason why he was because I was putting up dancing and funny videos, and I just figured one day I'm going to reach out to him to help me with a short film. And he replied 6 months later, and we've been a couple ever since.
Excuse me, I'm wiping away a tear. Let me ask you, Mr. Strassner, Cliff's a comedian,
mm-hmm.
wants to be at any rate, and bless him, an alcoholic who's given up drinking for 6 months before we meet him. I have to ask, is the story told here in any part your own?
Yes, very much so. I mean, the opening scene of the movie is how I actually got sober. You know, you mentioned the belt breaking, and that is my story. That happened one night, and the next day I finally asked for help, and I've been sober ever since.
Well, God bless.
Thank you.
And Jay Duplass, what put the character of Dr. Dee Dee, the personable dentist, in your creative mind?
Well, first of all, I just want to back up and say, you know, obviously inspired by Michael's life story and his humor around his life story, because when he told me about the belt breaking, he told me it was because he was holding a little bit of holiday weight. And I thought that showed a remarkable sense of humor and courage and vigor for life. And we started developing a story based on his origin story. And I had always had the thought of an independent film being made around an emergency dentist appointment. And we knew that this doctor needed to be very different from Cliff, very organized and very emotionally protected. And I had seen Liz Larson in a stage play of Transparent, which I was a part of that TV show, and yeah. She blew everyone out of the water. She had such an incredible singing voice, so much humor and strength and playfulness. But nothing really about that performance made me think that she would for sure be our Dr. Dee Dee. It was only after meeting her and talking to her about what she's been through in her life. So this story very much evolved from a lot of potential energy that had been pent up inside of Michael and Liz and myself throughout our lives, and most recently throughout the pandemic and the strikes.
And of course, you're if I may, best known for working with your brother Mark on films.
Yes.
And, of course, the acclaimed series Togetherness. What's it like to direct on your own? Or do you ever really direct a film on your own?
You definitely don't make a film on your own. It is a tremendously collaborative process. And I think the number one skill that you have to have as a director is being able to collaborate. I never wanted to direct on my own. Ever since I saw Raising Arizona in 1987, I wanted to be the Coen Brothers 2.0 with my brother. And like you said, Mark and I did that together as writer-director team. But a lot of life events got in the way, including my brother becoming a very famous actor and becoming who I think is maybe the best creative producer alive today. He did produce this movie for us, but it took 14 years for me to get back to making movies and continuing to fulfill my dream of making original films. And it felt amazing to finally do it. It's very scary to break up a partnership. But the truth is that I was very moved to tell Michael's story, to tell Liz's story, and for us to create something together. And I just, you know, focused on that. And as long as I stayed in the moment, it felt right.
Look, it's easy to see Cliff as a figure of fun, but he's trying to do something very brave.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing something brave just speaking of my own sobriety, you know, like the first 6 months into the year is the hardest time that I had to go through. Because it's the first time you're doing everything, you know? It's the first Christmas you're having, the first time you're watching a Ravens game without this thing that was so much a part of my life and a part of Cliff's life. You don't think you can do these things without it. And I didn't think I was going to be funny. I thought the alcohol was the special sauce. And in reality, it actually just hampered me more. And I was absolutely wrong about what sobriety is. Like, I've had more moments of pure joy and laughter doing this movie and just experiencing life than any time I ever had on alcohol and drugs.
Oh, my gosh, that's wonderful. Without giving too much away, the penultimate scene is at a pop-up comedy club in an auto shop, to which Cliff winds up bringing along his dentist because his car has been impounded. I'll just leave it at that. And she winds up helping him on stage.
Is this a dentist's office?
Oh, yeah.
Is there a reason why the door's locked? Is it because it's Christmas Eve or because we're in Dundalk? Okay, just a heads up. We are in a dentist's office here. Cool, for everyone involved, okay?
Okay.
Awesome, let's start up again. Here we go, and...
Okay. What do they begin to feel?
Well, I think that scene is... so important because, you know, in the scene prior, Cliff goes to help Dee Dee in her kind of Heart of Darkness moment where she's got to go back into her ex's house on Christmas Eve where he just got married. And the improv scene is definitely Cliff's Heart of Darkness going to a place where he doesn't really want to go anymore. And
he hurt some people too.
Yeah. There's a mixed crowd in there. You know, some people do not want to see him. Dee Dee ends up being the hero in that moment. And because you need somebody to do improv with. You can't do it by yourself. And you can't do life by yourself as well. You need people.
Things happen on stage that even Cliff can't anticipate. Surprises happen that they say yes and to. And it's because he's sober. It's because he's able to pivot in that moment and accept what's really happening that the sketch is able to become successful and truthful and honest. And what blossoms after that, continuing on stage, is they are able to use their stage characters to start to talk about their burgeoning attraction to each other. It's like a little low-rent Bill Shakespeare moment on stage up there where they can hide behind their characters and really start talking about the feelings that have been bubbling up between them over the course of the night.
Michael Strassner, is life an improv?
100%. Just continuing to say, as corny as it sounds, you know, yes and to life. Life gets bigger and bigger the more you're open to it, you know. It couldn't have been more of a crazier journey than what's been happening in the last 7 years. And it has all been an improvised set. And I'm just so grateful that the belt broke and I'm still here.
Michael Strassner and Jay Duplass, their new film, The Baltimoreans. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
And if you or someone you know is considering suicide or in crisis, please call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from The Economist. In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Click on that donate button to become a member. There are also many local news stories and conversations for you to check out there as well. KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. 10 o'clock, Dan Lentz, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. And that is followed at noon by the History of Recorded Jazz with Paul Kivy. Support comes from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at coleranebank.com, member FDIC. Partly sunny today, highs in the upper 70s to low 80s, and our lows tonight in the upper 50s. For tomorrow, partly sunny once again, highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s. Adventures in Lifelong Learning begins its fall season on Tuesday, September 23rd at the Bemidji Eagles Club. The group is open to all and meets every Tuesday, 10 a.m. with coffee and treats ready 20 minutes before. There will be a variety of speakers each week, beginning on the 23rd with Tom Staker on pigeon racing. Find a full schedule on